Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
First, some history. There have been American sanctions in place against Iran for decades now. Pretty much any trade or investment with the government is already verboten. But the Bush administration decided today more is better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation at publictransportation.org. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the 25th of October. Great to have you here. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has spent a good part of the past year or so trying to work on diplomatic overtures to Iran. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has taken a different tack with tough unilateral financial sanctions. Today, the stick beat out the carrot as Paulson and Rice jointly announced new economic pressures on Tehran, sanctions on Iranian banks, companies, and specific military units, including the elite Revolutionary Guard. But our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports the White House is going to need some help if this is going to work.
The Treasury and State Departments today accused three of Iran's state-owned banks of promoting nuclear proliferation and laundering money for terrorists. The U.S. will prohibit any financial transactions with any foreign company that does business with those banks or with Iran's military-industrial complex. Stuart Levy, the Treasury Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, expects global businesses will now steer clear of Iran.
Financial institutions around the world, they don't want to do business with terrorists. When we put this kind of information in the public domain, we have found that the private sector will often stop doing business with these entities.
If other countries go along, analysts say these sanctions could hurt Iran's economy. But Suzanne Maloney at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy isn't so sure foreigners will cooperate.
I think the international community views this step as moving a little bit further and a little bit faster than many of our allies would like to see. Clearly, the Russians and Chinese have been disinclined to move in a very severe, drastic way to alter their economic relationships with the Iranians.
And Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the administration has to overcome a credibility problem.
Throughout the region where the United States is seeking cooperation, the United States is often seen as anti-Islamic and as anti-Arab in the way it's approached the problems of counterterrorism.
State Department officials today denied the new sanctions were a prelude to armed conflict with Iran. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today's installment of the subprime saga takes us to the halls of the Congress of the United States. There's a new report out of the Joint Economic Committee that says the mortgage meltdown will cost billions in lost wealth, reduced tax revenues, and decreased property values. But as often happens when you start asking economists about things, kind of like when you talk to politicians, there are a couple of different points of view on this. Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports.
The report says 2 million more households will lose their homes when subprime mortgage rates readjust in the next 2 years. That alone will erase $100 billion in housing wealth. Foreclosed homes drop in value because they're auctioned for much less. Then neighbors also see their values fall. Jay Brinkman is an economist at the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says politicians are exaggerating the crisis.
Their report appears to be double what we are seeing and expecting in the market, even with fairly aggressive foreclosure rates that we are projecting.
Brinkman admits that states where lenders issued tons of subprime mortgages will take a hit: California, Florida, Ohio, and Michigan. But assuming for a second Congress is right, how devastating would 2 million foreclosures be to the economy? Gary Engelhardt teaches economics at Syracuse University. He says a $100 billion decline in property values won't make much of a consumer dent in the broader $12 trillion economy.
$5 to $10 billion in consumption is not a lot, relative to the whole economy. What can tip us into recession are the credit market effects, because those are broader. They'll affect the whole economy and they'll affect access to capital within the economy.
Engelhardt says the credit crunch is already playing out on Wall Street. Whether politicians and banks help prevent these foreclosures is unlikely to affect these financiers. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Congressman Charlie Rangel has this phrase he likes to use when he's talking about whatever his latest piece of legislation is. I don't think it's his. I think he stole it from Saddam Hussein. The Democratic chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee introduced what he's calling the mother of all tax reform bills today. Rangel's promising to lower taxes for 91 million families and, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, overhaul the entire tax code to the tune of almost $1 trillion.
Rangel says his bill would stick it to rich people and use the money from taxing them more to give everybody else a break. Although those are not exactly his words.
Taxpayers know best what to do with their money rather than government. We don't believe that you have to be rich in order to know what to do with your money.
The most expensive piece of Rangel's plan is to wipe out the alternative minimum tax. It was designed years ago for the richest taxpayers, but this year it could hit more than 20 million families. Getting rid of it would cost the government about $800 billion over the next 10 years. But Rangel would increase tax rates for hedge fund types, private equity partners, and married couples who make more than $500,000 a year.
What he's really doing is attacking small businesses. 75% of taxpayers at the top rate are job-producing small businesses.
Republican Congressman Jeb Hensarling is not a fan of the Rangel plan.
I think it lives up to its billing as the mother of all tax increases.
But Rangel's just getting started. He also wants to lower the corporate tax rate while eliminating a half a dozen popular loopholes. Wall Street hotshots are ready for a fight, and no one believes this bill will make it into law as long as President Bush is in the White House. But
I'm willing to work with any president in the next election, no matter who she is.
So for now, at least, Rangel's ideas about tax rates will have to wait. Instead, watch for Congress to pass a temporary one-year fix of the alternative minimum tax soon. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not much good, except it could have been a lot worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You've got one more day to weigh in with the Federal Communications Commission on this topic. Should the government force internet service providers, companies like AOL, to forward your email from, say, an AOL account to whatever it is that you're using now? A freelance editor in Washington, D.C. has petitioned the FCC to create just such a rule. We've called Declan McCullough at CNET to explain. Declan, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So what do you think of this thing? I mean, it sort of makes sense, just in a post office kind of way, that you'd want ISPs to forward your email, right?
Well, and you'd be right if the internet was designed like the post office or the telephone system, but it isn't, and so that's what makes this proposal a little bit silly. It would be like having a mailboxes, et cetera, box be required even after you shut down your service with them to forward your mail, when instead of the post office should be the one that handles this.
So what exactly might be a solution to this?
The solution is probably to say to someone, and this was a professional, a freelance writer who was running a business out of her home who asked the FCC for this, you spend $7 or $8 a year, get your own domain name, and handle the email forwarding there. That's what I do. I've been doing it for the better part of a decade, McCullough.org, and so when I switch internet service providers, I move from Washington to California, and now I have my McCullough.org email forward instead of Verizon, and now I forward it to AT&T. It works really well. That's the way to do it on the internet.
The ISPs that are involved in this case, AOL specifically, but also others who were asked to comment by the Associated Press, aren't. Why do you suppose they're not willing to pipe up on this one?
Well, I think they're probably not trying to dignify it with a response. The ISPs are not going to be in favor of this. It costs them money to forward email for someone who's not a customer. If the requirement were imposed, then they'll just jack up the cost for those of us who are still current customers to cover the cost of handling people who are no longer customers.
Let me ask you something that came into my mind as soon as I heard this story, and you touched on it briefly with your note about your website or anybody's own personal domain name. Why wouldn't somebody who's running a business, if they didn't want to deal with getting a domain name, get themselves a Yahoo Plus mail account or pay, you know, one of those web-based email services and just deal with it that way?
Exactly. I mean, anyone who's running a serious business out of an AOL.com address is just asking for trouble. I mean, that's not the mark of a serious business person. But, yeah, I mean, domain names are very, very cheap now, and that's the way to handle forwarding on the Internet. I mean, the Internet was not designed to handle email forwarding, and do you want your email to bounce through five different ISPs before it finally gets to you if you switched accounts a bunch of times? Probably not. And that also means there's a chain, so if one link in the chain is broken, your email is never going to arrive.
Declan McCullough is the political correspondent for News.com. Declan, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Oregon voters go to the polls in a special election about a week and a half from now. And what they see while they're on the way there might well have an impact on how they vote. Technically, they'll be deciding on a measure that will limit development. It's a tit-for-tat response to a highly controversial pro-growth initiative that passed back in 2004. But the politics will have cosmetic implications for the Beaver State's well-traveled roads, Oregon Public Broadcasting's Ethan Lindsay reports.
This year's vote in Oregon is a continuation of a three-year-old debate. In 2004, Oregonians overwhelmingly voted to give property owners a lot more freedom to build. That law, known here simply as Measure 37, lets landowners ignore any new laws passed since they first bought their land.
Hi, how are you?
Hey there.
The shabby Oregonians in Action office is in a Portland strip mall. The property rights activists who work here are the masterminds behind the movement that turned Oregon upside down. Ross Day is a lawyer with the group.
Measure 37 guarantees that the rights you had at the time you acquired your property are the rights you'll have until you sell your property. It's really quite that simple. It's a grandfather clause.
And he says many developers are now taking their newfound power to the streets. Oregonians have long been proud of their 8,000 miles of state highways. The pride many feel comes from the fact that the state has some of the least visually cluttered roads in the nation. That's because Oregon has regulated the quantity and quality of billboards for more than 35 years. Amy Joyce manages the state's billboard program.
Of those states that allow billboards at all, Oregon has had some of the tightest restrictions in the nation.
In the 1960s, Oregon embraced the ideas of Lady Bird Johnson, who wanted to keep highways clean. The state issued billboard permits on the basis of location and content, but capped that number at 2,500 and hasn't increased it since 1971. The limited supply made the permits tradable and worth up to $100,000.
I think the cap and replace system is unique to Oregon. It's not a black market. It's completely legal. They could obtain a permit, and they are freely transferable on the open market.
And says Amy Joyce, that market worked until Measure 37 passed, and a billboard company challenged the constitutionality of the permit system. The state Supreme Court struck down the system and said anyone could put up any billboard. Ross Day says the state had no right to pick one sign's content over another's. He remembers a time this issue came up with a client.
Tater Patch Quilt, right on the California-Oregon border. They had a giant sign, if you're facing it on the right. And on the left was the Welcome to Oregon sign. Their sign was okay, ours wasn't.
Amy Joyce says after the Supreme Court ruling,
I wouldn't call it an explosion, but there have certainly been a number of new signs that have gone up.
About 100 new billboards so far. But times, they are a-changin'. Opinion polls show voters in November may just reban unpermitted billboards. And if the measure passes, developers who bought land decades ago won't be able to do whatever they want with it. This summer, the state legislature reinstated the permit system and did it in a way that they say will avoid judging content in awarding billboards. Amy Joyce.
And then I expect a lot of litigation over what the new law means, what the old law meant.
Joyce says she expects that litigation to go on for years. In Portland, I'm Ethan Lindsay for Marketplace.
Coming up, a fundraising primer from one of the best.
I always ask the question of a board or my colleagues, how many times were you turned down this week? How many requests did you make for $10,000 or more where people said no?
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks were lower on Wall Street as credit concerns mounted and oil topped out at a record high. The Dow Industrials dropped less than a tenth percent, 3 points to close at 13,671. The NASDAQ was down 0.8%, 23 points, closed at 2750. The S&P 500 inched lower by a tenth of 1%, 1 point, ended the day there at 1514. $90.46 is the per barrel price for crude today. Investors were bearish on Merrill Lynch. Shares in the financial giant tumbled 3.75% after several brokerage houses downgraded its stock. AIG claimed nearly a 3.25% loss on fears that a large write-down might be in the insurance near future. Microsoft picked up more than 2.75% ahead of reporting its strongest quarterly growth in 7 years. After the bell, Gates & Company reported a 23% jump in profits. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.37%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529. By Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its consumer sentiment report for October. The National White Collar Crime Center wraps up the first global conference on economic and high-tech crimes. And Senator and presidential hopeful Hillary Rodham Clinton celebrates her birthday. She turns the big 6-0. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and his NATO counterparts wrapped up a two-day meeting in the Netherlands today. They've been talking about everything from the missile shield President Bush wants to build in Eastern Europe to how many troops European countries are willing to send to Afghanistan. Europe spends less on defense than the United States does, considerably less. But commentator David Frum says when Europeans do spend, they don't always do it wisely.
When it comes to trade, hypocrisy is business as usual. But there's one form of trade hypocrisy that carries a special cost, potentially a lethal cost, and that's what we see in defense industries. The NATO allies will soon reach a crucial decision about their next-generation air-to-ground fighter planes. Air forces are choosing between two finalists, the U.S., U.K., Italian F-35, or an update of the Franco-German Eurofighter. Just about everybody agrees that the F-35 is the better and probably cheaper plane. It's the plane that will be bought by the Israelis, who tend to be choosy about things bearing on national survival. The Eurofighter is built on 4 separate assembly lines in 4 Western European nations. This redundancy creates more jobs, but at a very high cost. High cost, in turn, reduces the number of aircraft the European allies can afford to purchase. Relative to national incomes, Americans pay 3 times as much for defense as most Western European nations, more than 4% of national income. Almost half of all the defense dollars spent on Earth are spent by the United States. It is the United States that pays to sustain the stable world order in which Europe prospers. Americans have accepted this disproportionate burden since 1945. In return, Americans do ask that those few defense dollars spent by the Allies be spent as efficiently as possible. When European governments spend defense dollars unwisely, when they protect their home market rather than buying the most advanced available weaponry, they do not just sin against free trade. They waste scarce resources that ought to be husbanded for the supreme mission of any government, national defense, and the preservation of peace. If the security of Europe is ever seriously challenged, Europe's defense protectionism will carry a cost that cannot be measured in money.
Once upon a time, David Frum was a speechwriter for President Bush. He's now a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. We are always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a line at our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
The boss will see you now.
Time once again for Conversations from the Corner Office. Usually on this segment, we sit down with the heads of major U.S. corporations to get their thoughts on issues facing their companies and their industries. But this time, we decided to leave the world of profits behind and talk to the head of an organization that doesn't measure success by earnings per share. Today, we're at Lincoln Center in New York City, considered one of the world's leading performing arts venues. In front of me stands the Metropolitan Opera House. To my right, Avery Fisher Hall, where the New York Philharmonic plays. 10 other major arts organizations also call these 16 acres of glass and limestone home. Reynold Levy is president of Lincoln Center, and these days he's ushered in a new sound that has nothing to do with virtuoso performance. Lincoln Center is getting its first ever top-to-bottom makeover to the tune of more than $1 billion. And as president, Reynold Levy's had to raise most of that money from private donors. At the same time, though, he's had to make sure Lincoln Center still gets enough contributions to meet its $90 million annual operating budget. In his office, nine stories above the jackhammers and the construction cranes, I asked him if there wasn't a risk of going to the well too many times.
No. First of all, there's an elasticity to giving. There's, in my experience, there's a lot more discussion about fundraising than there is fundraising. I always ask the question of a board or my colleagues, how many times were you turned down this week? How many requests did you make for $10,000 or more where people said no? And very, very frequently the answers fall short. Giving is like baseball. One out of every three hits, you bat 333, you're a most valuable player. So you need to step up to bat. And we live in a city and a country that's been blessed by an extraordinary amount of affluence. So it's my experience that the right approach by the right person results in gifts.
What's it like to make what the people in development call the ask? You call somebody up and say, I need $100,000, I need $1 million. I mean, walk us through that.
Well, it's an extraordinary amount of fun to find the intersection between the interests and background of a donor and the needs of an institution. If you find that intersection, that's the sweet spot. And my personal attitude is that we are really doing the prospective donor an enormous favor by asking for support, because their gift will provide a meaning and a consequence to their lives that will otherwise not exist.
You have run the AT&T Foundation, which is to say you were in the business of giving away money, of making charitable donations. Now you are on the other side of that equation. I'm curious as to your explanation of that sweet spot you mentioned.
Well, let's take a donor who is business-oriented. They're interested in strengthening Lincoln Center, and so we have developed a plan to change the economic model of Lincoln Center away from just relying on ticketed revenue and just relying on contributions to finding other sources of continuous revenue. That's been an evangelistic effort on my part. If there were oil under Lincoln Center, we would find it. We don't have oil. But
well, you know, at $90 a barrel. You
yeah,
know.
Not bad.
Not bad.
But we've got air rights.
Oh, there you go.
In abundance. And so we've explored what we could do with those air rights.
Air rights, which is to say the rights above these buildings.
Correct. Which can be transferred to developers and which has a dollar value which can be monetized.
You have a list, I'm sure, someplace in this office of the people you'd like to be donors. How do you keep adding to that list? How do you recruit? How do you get people interested in supporting Lincoln Center and the vision that you guys have?
Well, we have almost 3.9 million ticket buyers on an annual basis. So they've declared an interest in Lincoln Center. We also look at new sources of wealth. The real estate community in New York, which has always been generous, has had a particularly good run here in New York City in the last decade. The growth of hedge funds has been enormous. There are more hedge funds than mutual funds. And there's a significant concentration of hedge fund managers here in New York City. We've made it our business to get to know them and to find out who they are and to talk about Lincoln Center and to entertain them here and to introduce them to our place. And we continue to do that with great energy and enthusiasm.
The London Symphony was in town the day we were in New York City. Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto was on the program. Word is you can find Reynold Levy at a performance at Lincoln Center almost every night of the week. And so as we sat there and watched rehearsals, I asked him whether it's work or pleasure.
It's both. I do it to entertain potential donors. I do it because of the artistic administrators around the campus who appreciate the president of Lincoln Center really caring about their work. But I do it for another reason. I have the privilege of watching a piece of work on a stage and asking about an artistic decision. So for me, this has been just a fabulous learning laboratory about how arts are created and how they're performed.
Reynold Levy is the president of Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. Mr. Levy, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
For more on my talk with Reynold Levy and conversations from other corner offices, you can visit our website. It's marketplace.org.
Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, also sponsoring PBS's CEO Exchange, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, more of a comment, really, on the state of technology in our lives. A study out today from Zogby International and 463 Communications showed almost one in four Americans said the internet could replace a significant other, at least for a certain period of time. 20% of us wouldn't mind putting computer chips in our children as a way to keep track of where they are. Fully half said the government ought to control internet content in some way. Finally, and I'm not really sure what this means, it's just weird, but on a relative scale, Halle Berry and Patrick Dempsey, the guy from Grey's Anatomy, they were judged to be sexier than the iPhone. Not that Steve Jobs cares either way. At the close today, almost $183 a share. Apple's got a higher market capitalization than IBM. That, of course, is the company that used to make computers using that other company's operating system. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dipped 3 points. That's less than a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ fell 23 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 dropped 1 point. That is a tenth of 1% there. Our editors include Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. Coming up next time, cashing in on the costume craze.
Usually I'm a fairy or something fully covered or a nurse, but I figure I'll go sexy this year. I'm 30. It's dirty 30, I guess.
I don't even want to know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.